Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Crown and Anchor Greyhounds. This is Richmond Till We Die, a conversation about the Apple TV Plus show Ted Lasso, where we explore the characters, their relationships to each other, and how they're able to make us laugh until we can hardly breathe one moment, then feel with the deepest parts of our hearts the next. I'm Christian, and I have the brightest of Greyhound glows today because we get to talk to a World Cup champion for the first time ever today.
I'm Brett, and I am excited to talk to a player who appeared in one of my favorite computer sports games of all time, Backyard Soccer.
For this bonus episode, we're thrilled to welcome our guest, Brianna Scurry.
Brianna Scurry!
She is a legendary goalkeeper who played for the U.S. Women's National Team between 1994 and 2008. She earned a record 173 caps for the United States, started 159 of those matches, and finished her international career with a record of 133, 12, and 14, including 71 shutouts.
She was a member of the gold medal winning U.S. Women's National Team at the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta. She played every minute of the historic 1999 Women's World Cup, allowing only 3 goals and recording 4 shutouts, helping lead the U.S. to the title. And she's won pretty much every individual honor you can possibly win.
Along the way, Scurry has been a pioneer. She became one of the first women to participate in a women's paid professional league, one of the first African-American professional female soccer players, and one of the first out LGBT players. She recounts all of this in her new autobiography, My Greatest Save, which tells the true story of all her exploits, as well as her journey out of severe depression that she experienced as a result of a traumatic brain injury that she suffered at the end of her playing career. Brianna's story is one of perseverance and determination, and we were so fortunate to have this opportunity to chat with her about her journey. So, Greyhounds, please join us in giving a warm welcome to one of the greatest American superheroes of our time, Brianna Scurry.
Yay. Thank you so much for being with us, Brianna. It is an honor.
Thank you. Thank you.
So let's start with the most important things in life, Ted Lasso. I'm interested in knowing how you came to get into Ted Lasso, and also how do you process and enjoy watching the show as a professional soccer player? Because it seems like there could be a lot of things that might be distracting or nitpicky, and yet you're still there loving the show like a lot of us normal.
I do. So I first got into Ted Lasso when I had so many friends ask me if I've seen Ted Lasso, and I said, no, not yet. And then somebody else would ask me, and they're like, oh, Ted Lasso. And I was like, okay, not yet. And then I got Apple TV, and we were on, right? So then that's how I got into it, because I was excited to watch it. And it's a fantastic series. And I really like that, and I didn't really realize this when people were telling me about it, but there is a direct link and similarity to my high school coach. Mm. His name was David Tank. He was our high school basketball, boys basketball coach. He was asked when I came into to play high school soccer, and 3 of my teammates from my club team, he was asked to be the coach of the soccer team. No experience, 0 with soccer. And his assistant coach, Mr. Feligi, zero. but they read up on it, right? Mr. Felicky read up on it, and he got to understand some lingo and some methodologies and some things. But it didn't matter because we won state championship my senior year with David Tank as our coach. And so I have a little place in my heart actually for Ted Lasso because, you know, when I was first started watching it, I was like, huh, this is so like similar to my high school career. Obviously it didn't quite end up the same, but it started the same. So yeah, it was really cool. I wasn't aware of that, but I love it. I think it's so, so funny, so charming, so everything.
It's interesting that you mentioned those similarities because there is this iconic scene in Ted Lasso season 2 where the team is getting ready to play in their FA Cup semifinal and he takes them to Wembley Stadium. Before the match starts, the whole entire place is empty and he gives them a pep talk. And mm-hmm. It's very reminiscent, even an homage to a scene in the movie Hoosiers. Your coach did something similar before your state's tournament semifinal. Can you explain that experience to our audience?
I totally can. So we got to the semifinals, and in order to not have us be overwhelmed by the magnificence of the Metrodome or the gravity of the game, coach took us out of school early, and we took the bus downtown Minneapolis to the Metrodome, and he had us walk around the dome, had us go, you know, in the cavernous underbelly of the dome. And then he had us go onto the field and just lay there and just look up at the dome and get a feel for it and imagine ourselves there. And we just were quiet and we're walking around. And he was saying, this is a soccer pitch. This is no different than any other field you've ever played on. It's exactly the same. He said, don't be scared or rattled by it. Rattled was one of his favorite words. Don't be rattled by it. And he used to call us the minnows. And he said, the minnows will come in here and we will win. And so you have to know that and believe that and get over the initial feelings of anxiety or excitement or jitters or whatever. And that really helped get us grounded before we played that game.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Kind of fast forwarding to where soccer is now. We've gone through this phase with women's soccer in this country where there were a lot of disheartening stories for a while. There were stories coming out of NWSL about abusive relationships. And then there was this longstanding struggle for our women's national team in regard to equity and equality and compensation. And we wanted to root for the players while at the same time being really frustrated with the institutions within which they existed. And now recently, it seems like there have been a lot of wins. And so there has been a collective bargaining agreement for our national team players. And NWSL, especially with the addition of San Diego and Los Angeles this year, there's been like really good woman-centered energy there. What's been the most encouraging story from your vantage point from women's soccer over the last year to 6 months?
Well, clearly, if we're asking that question specifically, I would say equal pay for the women's national team, clearly a big win. I mean, a 30-year win, a long walk win. I mean, the best possible thing you could ever win in our journey for, you know, equal pay. It's been a 30-year journey. And I was involved in it in the 90s and obviously the 2000s with my team, but the 96 team fought for it. Back then it was, you know, massage therapists and, you know, nice hotels and no middle seats on flights and childcare. And then now it's literally the money and the big money, the prize money and whatnot. And having Cindy Parlacone at the helm for president of the Federation, I think was complete game changer. That's the one element of that was different than any other time. And I think that's the one that made the most difference was one of us was in the position of power to be able to do that. With regards to NWSL, I think the biggest win was those two teams you mentioned, San Diego and LA, in my opinion. I mean, soccer had, you know, league soccer, club soccer, I guess you'd call it, hasn't been in the California state for a long time. And the other two iterations of the league, those teams just didn't seem to make it. I mean, they either died off or they were, you know, closed down with the rest of the leagues that didn't last for more than 3 years. So you have a 10-year league that now has not one but two teams in California. You have the former coach for the national team at the helm in San Diego, Jill Ellis. And then you have sisters of mine on the national team in ownership positions in LA, and people, you know, women from a whole other profession that are owners as well, the acting profession. And so it's a real coming together, and it's so exciting to see that happen now. But I have to say, it is disappointing, you know, how the league was going last year. I think what happened there with all the abuses and the coaches going from one place to another place, and nothing really being done in regards to the violations that were going on. It really was a systemic issue. And it was the system of the NWSL that had missed the mark on that. They just didn't do that. And I understand in part why they said that they didn't do that. They want to infringe on that coach, but I'm sorry, you can't take the side of the perpetrator against the victim.
Yeah.
And you allowed it to essentially just spread throughout the whole. I mean, some of them were on multiple teams over many, many years and doing the same thing. And it's just not okay anymore. It's just not that kind of coaching and that kind of culture of, you know, tyrannical culture and coaching is just not okay anymore.
You mentioned it briefly, kind of like glossed over here in our conversation there. You tell about it much more in detail in the book, but you and your contemporaries fighting for better working conditions to the point where even you write about how Billie Jean King encouraged you to essentially like strike and to be your own collective bargaining. What kinds of reactions did you share with your contemporaries when you saw this generation of players finally win a victory that you started fighting for, and that has been a fight for way too long?
I mean, Billie Jean King, let me just talk about her for a second. She is absolutely outstanding, amazing, still to this very day, fighting for equality for women, period, in all areas, not just in pay for sports and athletes, but in business, in your personal lives, in your personal body, your freedoms for yourself. She's fighting for that, and she's been doing it, you know, probably since she could talk. When she was little, she was probably fighting for that. And she continues to do it to this day. And she is absolutely amazing. She definitely did inspire us and encourage us to, you know, commit to going on strike if it was necessary during the 95-96 window, because we had the most leverage. And she understood that we had that leverage. And our team was going to go to the Olympic Games in 96. We were probably going to be favored to win. It was, the Olympics were in this country. And so the Federation was going to be listening. Well, the Federation wasn't very nice back then either. When we decided to do that, and there was nine of us, me included, that did that. And so we did get them to bend the knee and do some of the things, or most of the things that we wanted. But that was just the tip of the iceberg. And now with the players that are playing, that are actually in camp right now for the qualifiers next month, you know, they have come a long way. There's so many fantastic young women on that team who stood up to the Federation, who fought for equality, who achieved it in all aspects of pay on that team. And also the piece of, that particular agreement that a lot of people don't know about is the revenue share piece. So the reason that's important is just because, so for 30 years, if you think about this, 30 years, the two teams and the Federation in a triangle, the Federation has been fighting against both the men's and the women's teams for 30 years in different time frames, and as adversaries, not as partners, you know. And now we have a collective adjoining of the two teams and the Federation going in the same direction. And that's the first time in 30 years. So now corporations can look at our sport and our governing body and say, hey, you know what? They're doing the right thing now. The optics are completely different. And so now what you have is a pie that is this big, that could be this big, by all these corporations wanting to get involved now. And that revenue share piece allows all those players, men and women, a piece of that pie.
That's awesome. Yeah. And, you know, history is never linear, right? And so you fought for the things that you fought for, and you talk about in the book some of the racism that you faced and various things that your family faced. And we're living in a time now where as much as it's great that the U.S. women's national team has gained a victory in the broader culture, it seems like there have been a lot of regressions. Voting rights are being rolled back. Many states are kind of hastily passing laws that target the LGBTQ plus community.
Right.
And even today, just a few hours before we were recording this, the Supreme Court rolled back Roe versus Wade.
Right.
And so as you reflect on having fought a bunch of battles and seeing some victories and now seeing some regression, how do you process that? And then also as a mom, like, how do you talk about that with your kids about your experiences and what's happening now?
Well, let me take the how I talk about with my kids first, that part of the question. Krista and my kids, my stepkids, are so engaged to all of this stuff. My stepson, Andrew, is constantly asking Krista and I what we think about certain things. Most of them all political. And so he's very in tune. He saw what happened today and he's already asked us about it. You know, what do we think about this? What does this mean? You know, he has myself and his moms. I'm a bonus mom. So the fact that one of the justices mentioned, potentially looking at gay marriage now, I mean, like you said, with the rollbacks of rights, it's very hurtful, first of all. Yeah. And it's untenable, really. It's really frustrating. So into the first part of your question, you know, about all these changes, when you're fighting for freedoms and equality, the fight is ongoing. You cannot rest. You cannot look the other way. You have to consistently fight for that, because what happens over time, if you aren't paying attention, is certain things slide into place. And then before you know it, you know, the adversary strikes against you if you are sleeping at the wheel. And I feel with the three Supreme Court justices that were put into power during Donald Trump's reign, this is now what you have. You have the result of that is what we've seen, and also an emboldening of Republican state senates all over the country, you know, making these laws. And they're so frustrating, because I read some of them, I'm like, really? Are you telling me that you really think that young trans kid decided to join a women's sport, and so now he's saying he's a trans kid and he, you know, just wants to seek an advantage in that sport? That's ridiculous. I just some of this stuff is just so absurd. And it's so frustrating. And it's like, it's not just in the states that I don't live in, because I live in Virginia and we're doing okay. It's you know, a lot of those states that are southern of me. But I mean, it's just the mere idea of trying to take away rights is absurd to me. We had a rapid expansion in the late, 2005 to 2010, when Obama was president, obviously. And now we're having a regression. And we need to wake up. We need to understand what's going on, get informed, and get involved.
Yeah, well, one of the great things about your book is that you are able to bring together all these different historical through lines, and you have a great grasp of your place in that timeline. So was that something that you set out to do when you began writing the book, or is that something that you sort of incorporated as you were in the writing process?
Actually, I think it's both. So when we first considered writing the book, myself and my team, my publicist, Patrick, and my wife and business manager, Krista, we thought about a theme. You know, how would we theme my life? Would we say I'm, you know, a trailblazer? Am I a, am I resilient? Am I a warrior? Like, what is it that I am exactly? And what ended up happening, we realized that I'm all those things. And so it just made sense. My existence, because I am, you know, so I'm gay, I'm a woman, I'm African American, I've had great success in a sport that's predominantly suburban and white. I mean, as a sport that's also not super popular at the time when I started playing it in this country. So I have a lot of things that I'm trying to break through. And it just made a lot of sense just to essentially write my story in a real honest and truthful way. But obviously I had to also include the trenches, if you will, from the great things to the not so great things, the colorful landscape that my life has been, and everything in between. And if I just tell my story with truth and honesty when it was good and when things that happened were bad, like self-sabotage or, you know, losing my position as number one keeper, my issues, with teammates like Hope Solo, talking about my mom dying, my dad passing away, my concussion issues. Just if I'm just honest and truthful about all of it, that'll be the best way to do this book. And then that's exactly what we did, Wayne and I.
Yeah, I loved, for people who may not have read like The Warmth of Other Suns, you talked about your family's history of kind of migrating north. Yeah. And one of the things that your dad wanted to do at one point in time was to open a barbecue restaurant and
yes.
name it after you. And we love barbecue on yes. our show. Ted Lasso loves barbecue. And I was just wondering, like, as you remember your dad, how would you characterize his barbecue style and what was one of the favorite things that you had that he cooked?
I would characterize his style as somewhat eclectic.
That's the
best kind. He liked to try different things in different combinations and different kinds of rubs and sauces. And he liked sometimes to use charcoal and sometimes he put, wood in it and sometimes he wouldn't. And sometimes he would just do different things. He marinate and sometimes he didn't. And he would try and experiment a lot with different styles. But by far, in my opinion, his barbecue chicken. I don't know what he did to that stuff because it was a family secret, which is why we're opening the barbecue place. As you know, being in Kansas City area, you got secrets that you don't tell anyone. And he took them to his grave, consequently. But his barbecue chicken, oh my goodness, I don't know what it was, but it had so much flavor. And the breast meat in particular, if you don't cook it right, it gets dry.
Yes.
But his breast meat was so good and it was so juicy and flavorful. And the skin was just crispy. And I don't know what he did with it to it, but he found a combination that was fantastic with regards to his barbecue chicken.
And people missed out. I mean, he had how he had the sign made and then they kind of tripped him up on some zoning stuff and then he wasn't able to. I wanted to look up who was on the zoning committee back then and even write a letter today.
I know, right?
Frustrated for you.
Who did that? Who was that?
Who's responsible for this?
It is Ryan here and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Part of your story that you tell in the book is how you had to really fight for proper physical and mental health care after you retired from playing. And part of that story is that it really led you through and to a dark place.
Right.
How common do you think it is amongst retiring athletes, maybe particularly in women's soccer, but across the board? How common do you think that is? And in an ideal world, what would aftercare look like for a retired professional athlete?
Right. So if you look at the construct of the psychology of a lot of athletes, when they're playing their sport, they know subconsciously that it's a small window and I'm going to be able to play from here to here, but I'm going to live way past that. And I'm going to have a lot longer life after I'm done playing my professional sport. So that sport in a lot of cases is, obviously woven into their identity and who they are. A lot of athletes are superstitious about thinking about what do I do after? And they don't necessarily have a plan in advance of their retirement as to what they're going to do, who they're going to do it with, how they're going to do it. They just don't have all these things figured out because it's almost seen like taboo, because I don't want to jinx my career. If I start thinking about that or talking about it, I'm going to get hurt or something like that. And it's a very odd and very common feeling about it. And so a lot of times athletes don't prepare in advance. So they prepare when the game is gone and it's a little bit too late. And they also don't realize that they need a buffer after they're done playing to really rest and figure out who they are, because the who they are is so much tied into what they were doing. And fortunately for me, I've always been someone who just, I'm exceptional at playing soccer. It is not who I am. But who I am is very much my mind, my body, my spirit. And so in the case for me with my head injury, my mind was the thing that was broken. And so therefore all of me was. And so I had a really hard time adjusting to my head injury because I've had them before, but that concussion was so different than every other concussion I had that the person came in from the side. I never saw her coming. I wasn't able to brace or move or do anything that protected myself. And she just hit me broadside on my right side of my head with her knee. And it didn't seem like it was anything major, but it ended up being the biggest event of my life. And I haven't played since then. To this very day, I haven't played in a soccer game. So I started a descent into madness from the disconnection that happens so often. And a lot of folks who have TBI know that you essentially get disconnected from who you are in everything that you do. And everything becomes gray for that period of time where your brain isn't healthy. And for me, it was 3 years. And part of the reason it was so bad is because the emotional part that most people don't talk about was the part like depression, anxiety, panic attacks, just the loneliness and feeling of being isolated was the disconnection. And I didn't understand that the reason I felt like this was because of my concussion. It wasn't until I got the right doctor who was able to help me, and he understood that, and he made me understand that, Bri, this is not you. You are feeling this way because you're hurt, and because you're hurting and your brain's still hurting. And so when I finally got the right doctor, after fighting the insurance company for 3 years, I was able to come out of it. But it's hard. It's hard. I mean, a lot of women have concussions from, you know, domestic violence, car accidents, workers, you know, workplace accidents. I mean, there's a lot going on there. And for the longest time, people kept asking me, well, Bri, were you depressed because your career ended? You know, maybe that's what it was. And at first I was like, well, maybe. And then I realized, no, it had nothing to do with that. And my doctor made me understand that.
You have a beautiful passage at the very beginning of the book where you say, I wouldn't change a thing. I love who I am. I love the path that I walked. And then you proceed to tell the story of that path. Sometimes it was jubilant and sometimes it was very difficult and dark. If there's someone who's listening to the conversation that we're having today and they don't feel comfortable with who they are, they don't feel accepted for who they are, they don't feel like the path has enough light to see through right now, what's something that you would say to them now that you've been able to kind of come through the darkness to a place where you have some perspective on that difficult period?
Find a reason to live. Find a reason to go on. Find a reason to wake up in the morning, even if it's something as small as going on a walk, which is what I had to do in my deepest, darkest times. I had to focus on what I could control. And I could control going on a walk every day. And as I did that, I realized I was literally and figuratively walking closer to a solution and to help and to assistance that I needed. If you're in that dark place right now and you feel like you're not being accepted and you feel like you're all alone, reach out for help. And unfortunately, for some kids in particular, or young people, their parents aren't very understanding and accepting. And that's really sad. But there are hotlines. There are people out there. Trevor Project is a great example, who will help you to get to where you need to go, who can give you a lifeline to help you understand who you are and what you need and what your purpose is. I found that for me, and the difference between myself and a lot of successful people that end up committing suicide successfully, a lot of people look at them or me and say, well, you have everything you could possibly want. Why would you want to kill yourself? Well, the one thing that I lost and that all those folks didn't have was a reason to live.
I don't know that I would call it a reason to live necessarily, though I suppose it could be for someone. But one thing that can literally change the state of our mind is just putting on a record that we love, turning on something on our Apple Music that we enjoy listening to. It can literally change your entire, how you feel about just whatever's going on. Like, music is that powerful. Is there something, is there a song, an album, an artist in your life now, or maybe during those darker times that you found particularly life-giving and that you would, you know, recommend?
Well, back in the day, when I used to play, one of my favorite artists was Whitney Houston.
Oh my gosh.
The song, yeah. The song, It's Not Right, But It's Okay. She's very, like, that. First of all, that beat is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then the lyrics, you know, she's like, I don't need you. I'm going to be okay.
Yep.
And that was, it's a rather defiant song. And so that was something that always fired me up.
That was when the like clean cut Whitney, like she broke out of that mold a little bit with some of those songs.
She
was like, this is my little subtle rebellion. Oh my gosh.
Exactly.
Great choice.
It makes you wonder now that you know her history, you know, what her mindset was at the time she recorded that.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah.
When she wrote it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so much music is that way, right? Mm-hmm. Like you said, Adele, I love her. She's so amazing. And her songs are, if you're willing to be a hopeless romantic that knows you might get your heart ripped out, but you go for it anyway, and then you have a relationship and you're all into it and you dive in and then it goes away. I think Adele understands that psychology in her music better than anyone I've ever heard in my life. I mean, the lyrics in so many of her songs, her previous album, her new one too, but her previous album just are so powerful. And I think she's amazing. Lady Gaga gets that.
Yes.
So I am willing to listen to these songs now. But when I was in that dark, deep space, those songs would literally like make me get on the floor and cry. Because I was literally a pool of gasoline back then. And the slightest little thing would tilt me into that dark space. And so now I get the joy of listening to the lyrics and the intricacies of these songs because they don't tip me over anymore.
Yeah.
Because I'm, you know, I'm strong and I'm stable and I know it's just a song. But I also understand how that person might have felt when they wrote it.
Yeah.
Because I've been there.
Yeah. I think those are all great choices, particularly with how the songwriting careers of both Lady Gaga and Adele have gone, especially the last decade or so.
Right.
They are just two artists who really understand the way to, I don't want to say harness vulnerability, but the way like that can be such an important and valuable way to communicate not just your vulnerability, but your strengths too. Like there is a strength of character in being able to see that whole body of work on an album or even through a whole discography. And
absolutely.
So I think that's why you can listen to the Adele song that's like, I'm never going to love again, right alongside the other one where she's like, I'm like hopelessly, endlessly in love with you. And you don't think this is a fake person. Like you get it because you've lived it.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Totally.
Exactly. You guys get me. I love it.
No. Oh, I mean, Whitney is always the right answer in my opinion. So like, that was a great start.
I want to bring us back as we close out to something thematically that you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, where you said that your high school soccer coach reminded you a lot of Ted Lasso. You have gotten to hang out with a lot of soccer players over the years. If you could have one of your former teammates or opponents have a guest spot in Ted Lasso, who would you like to see pop up on screen?
I can't pick myself.
No, because we all want to finagle our way onto the set of Ted Lasso.
She's like, for your consideration, me in the show.
Can I consider myself, please? me.
I understand that impulse 1,000%.
I would say Mia Hamm.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I love me some Mia Hamm. I tell you what, she is so humble and amazing with all that she had on her shoulders. I mean, she has her own building at Nike, for crying out loud, the Mia Hamm building. And so she had all this pressure and expectation on her 96, 99. And she was as kind and funny and just a generous person who has such humility. and always deflecting, oh, you know, make sure you talk to my teammates, you know, oh, it was a team effort, oh, we did it together, like all the time. And she meant it. And a lot of people thought she was aloof, but actually she was shy. She's shy. And she's such a great person. So a Ted Lasso cameo would be great if she were in it.
There's still time. So hopefully
there's still time. Okay, good.
I would like to think that her cameo is something like she shows up randomly and one of the Richmond players like is secretly super obsessed with her career or something. And it's just like way that too nervous to talk to her.
Would be awesome.
Too shy.
Yes. Too shy.
Too shy. Exactly. That would be perfect.
That would be awesome. Gosh. And we know that one of the AFC Richmond goalkeepers just can't get over his injury. So if Zero goes down too, you might get called into action. We will petition.
Let's go!
Let's do it.
Put me in, coach. I'm ready. Let's do it.
Well, we thank you so much for your time today. I thank you for the way in which you wrote the book, because there are a lot of athletes that write books, but I found this one to be particularly vulnerable, but at the same time, you did such a great job of interjecting some comedic moments into it.
Yes.
And so
yes,
it felt Ted Lasso-y to me. Like, you knew how much we could handle, and then you gave us a little reason to laugh, and then you got back into it. So thank you for everything, and we really appreciate talking to you, and we encourage everybody to pick up the book and read it, because there's something in there to teach and to delight and to inspire. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, man. I will say, I do have the audiobook version for all of us who like to just listen to things as we go along through our day.
Perfect.
I'm the one that did it. It's available on Audible, and you can grab it right now.
Yes. The author reads are the best ones.
That is one of my favorite genres, is nonfiction, like memoirs read by the person who wrote them. That's like literally my favorite audiobook to read, whatever, to listen to.
So I am extra
excited about that.
I will give it the highest compliment. I'm going to pick it up on audiobook, and I'm going to listen to it at 1x speed.
Wow. Really,
I'm
like,
honored that you're doing that. Thank you.
Really, like, savor it.
Yeah.
And that is our show. We hope you enjoyed our discussion with Brianna and learning more about her life, her career, and her new book, My Greatest Save. You can check out the show notes for links to her website, as well as the other cool stuff we talked about in this episode.
We'll be back soon with more Ted Lasso conversations, but you can keep the conversation going on Twitter and Instagram. Our handle on both platforms is at Ted Lasso Pod.
This episode of Richmond Till We Die is brought to you by Gin and Kerosene Productions. It was produced by me, Brett.
And me, Christian.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please take a moment to give our show a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and subscribe to our feed. It's the best and easiest way you can show your support for the pod. I'm Brett, signing off for Christian and Brianna Scurry. Thanks for listening. Until next time, cheers, y'all.